plan on flying? It's time to upgrade to a real ID. Because in order to board domestic flights, your driver's license or state-issued ID must be a real ID, or you'll need another acceptable form of identification. So don't wait. Find out how to get your real ID at tsa.gov/real ID. That's tsa.gov/real ID. Or visit your local DMV. And then you'll be cleared for takeoff.
Hello, and welcome back to ACRAC. I'm Jed Wolpaw, and I am thrilled to have back with me today the one and only Dr. Jillian Isaac for another keyword episode. This is our 22nd in this series. Hard to believe it's flown, but these are really, I think, well-received and really fun to do. I learn a lot, and Jillian, really appreciate all your work here. And so we're going to talk today about another two keywords, muscular dystrophies and trisomy 21. Jillian, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
Before we start, I want to give a big shout out to all the dental anesthesiologists out there. It was really fun to meet a bunch of you at your annual meeting, and thanks for having me as a speaker. All right, so Jillian, where do we want to start?
Yeah, so this particular keywords come from the advanced test outline. What I have learned is that residents don't ever look at the ABA outline because it's like, it's really long, a little bit overwhelming, but I spend a lot of time combing through it. And the muscular dystrophies and the trisomy 21 is just in a long list of pediatric medical problems with anesthesia implications. So that would include like cystic fibrosis, developmental delay, childhood obesity, skeletal abnormalities, and there's a whole list of these. So we will slowly work our way through. I think there's about 10 or 12 of them, but the two I picked for today are muscular dystrophies and then trisomy 21. Mostly because they're the easier questions to find, probably. And I do know that in general, I very much avoid peds anesthesia because it is not my wheelhouse. It's not my forte. And I just want to say that I am by no means an expert in any of this. Like my whole thought behind the keywords was not to be an expert, but to help people know what's on the test and help guide them study for the test. So I just want to put that out there. That I don't do peds anesthesia. I haven't done a pediatric patient in probably 15 years, but it's also fun to study and relearn some of these things.
Yeah, and I'm in the same boat, certainly not an expert on pediatric anesthesia in any stretch of the imagination. And I will say, you know, we really appreciate people do go on the show notes and comment when they realize either we made a mistake, which absolutely can happen, or there may be a mistake in some of these questions. These are not, you know, guaranteed to be foolproof questions. So sometimes there's a mistake there, or just to help with a better explanation for why something's right or why something's wrong. So please feel free. This really should be, you know, a crowdsourced where everyone's helping each other.
So starting with the muscular dystrophy, there are three that the board really wants you to know about. It's Becker's muscular dystrophy, Duchenne muscular dystrophy, and then myotonic dystrophy. And then the other really common question is the disorders that are associated with malignant hyperthermia. They're really rare. I don't think I've ever come across someone with King-Denham-Burrow syndrome or with mini core disease, but they really want you to know it. It's like a every year type of a question. So just starting with the dystrophies, just a quick review. Muscular dystrophy, it's a group of hereditary diseases characterized by painless degeneration and atrophy of skeletal muscle. There's usually symmetric skeletal muscle weakness and wasting. They're X-linked disorders, so they affect men typically more than women for that reason. And they're both caused by the Duchenne and Becker muscular dystrophy are both caused by a mutation on the X chromosome that prevents normal formation of dystrophin. And that's the key protein that stabilizes a muscle cell. So without that dystrophin, the muscle cells just really start degrading. And for lack of a better word, they became they're like sad little muscle cells and they lyse very quickly. Usually Becker's muscular dystrophy progresses at a slower rate than Duchenne's muscular dystrophy, but most patients have symptoms by adolescence in both of them. The key thing to know is that patients with both, and I'm going to abbreviate them as DMD and BMD, they both may have life-threatening perioperative complications related to triggering agents that can induce skeletal muscle breakdown. The biggest one is succinylcholine, and that can cause just profound hyperkalemia and rhabdomyolysis because it hits those muscle cells and they just break apart. And you want to avoid these triggering agents. And also some of the volatile anesthetics can lead to muscle breakdown. It's not going to be as severe as with succinylcholine, but you can see it with any of the inhaled anesthetics. So the intraoperative management obviously is to avoid triggering agents and take into account that musculodystrophy patients are at increased risk for cardiac conduction abnormalities. That's a big question that they like to ask. It's really common that these patients have cardiac issues also. Aspiration, hypersensitivity to anesthetic agents, and then metabolic abnormalities, including hyperkalemia and hyperglycemia. So as to what's on the test, so this part is a little bummer. I like the website Open Anesthesia. There's a lot of keywords. It's kind of crowdsourced. You can read the keywords and the information. And they used to tell you how often those keywords were tested. Like they would said this was tested in 2020 and 2019. And I never knew how they got that data or where it came from, but it's gone now. So I can't tell you like how frequently this is tested. I can just go by, I look through lots of questions, and when you read thousands of questions, you start seeing similar ones over and over. So I try to do that. I try to pull questions and topics that I think the board really wants you guys to know. So we will start there. So question one, which of the following conditions is a contraindication to the use of succinylcholine? So A, burns of 50% body surface area occurring 12 years ago. B is cirrhosis. C is myotonic dystrophy. D is a seizure disorder. And E is a spinal cord transection within the past 6 hours.
Yeah, I think A was 12 hours ago, not 12 years ago, right?
Right.
Okay.
Oh, did I say years? I'm sorry. Yeah. I'm really tired. I'm functioning like...
No worries. I think, but that is significant. So...
that is very important.
Yeah, it's very important. And as you said earlier, so myotonic dystrophy is one of those things you would definitely not use sucks for. Could be, you know, definitely life-threatening in terms of causing hyperkalemia. So the answer is going to be C. The reason it's not burns over 50% of the body surface area is because it was only 12 hours ago. So it takes 24 to 48 hours for the denervation, for the proliferation of the extrajunctional receptors that can lead to acetylcholine receptors that can lead to the hyperkalemia. And so they haven't had time yet if the burn was 12 hours ago. Cirrhosis doesn't cause that. Seizure disorder doesn't cause it. And then spinal cord transection, again, within the past 6 hours, hasn't had time yet. So key to know that burns over 50% of the body and spinal cord transection both would do it if it had been, you know, 2 or 3 days ago, but not at only 6 or 12 hours.
And you know what? In my preoperative, I am post-call. I'm working on very little sleep. So if I make mistakes, please call me out. In my reading up, in my little spiel ahead of time, I didn't cover myotonic dystrophy. And that is actually one I remember in studying that I saw questions and it just never really stuck, but it's definitely being tested. And so I just want to go through myotonic dystrophy really quick. So that's a muscular disorder where you still have the progressive muscle weakness like you would see in a Duchenne or a Becker muscular dystrophy. But the unique part is you get these prolonged contractions. So you can have I wouldn't say it's a muscle spasm, but like your hand can claw down or your muscles can just really clamp down. And you get that along with progressive weakness. And they have a lot of the same issues intraoperatively that you would see with the other muscular dystrophies, like the cardiac issues, aspiration, sensitivity to drugs, and metabolic abnormalities. It's one of those things that it's really rare. And I did do a little bit of a deep dive on it. So the Myotonic Dystrophy Foundation actually has a really wonderful website and has a list of different documents. And one of them is practical suggestions for the anesthetic management of a myotonic dystrophy patient. So if you ever do have a patient that comes in, it's a great resource. It's really easy to look through. It has like a nice overview with different bullet points of what to think about. So I just wanted to point that out.
Great. Thank you.
All right. So question two, hyperkalemia is not a risk for patients receiving succinylcholine with which of the following? A, multiple sclerosis, B, myasthenia gravis, C, Guillain-Barré syndrome, D, Becker muscular dystrophy.
So here, hopefully what jumps out at you is that myasthenia gravis is the opposite, right? They're resistant to succinylcholine because they've lost their acetylcholine receptors. They've been attacked in this autoimmune disorder. And so they are resistant to succinylcholine and you can use it, but you need to use more. So right away, even if you didn't know any of the rest of it, you should say, oh yeah, hyperkalemia, definitely not a problem with myasthenia gravis. So that's the answer. Multiple sclerosis is does have that risk, and Guillain-Barré does, as does Becker muscular dystrophy. So all of those end up in denervation of some kind, exactly, or muscle wasting, which ends up with more of those extrajunctional receptors.
So this next question is, I alluded to it earlier, but it's the patients that are susceptible for malignant hyperthermia. And I just want to point that out now, because this is like almost guaranteed that you're going to see this. I would even put it maybe even fair game on the basic, but this is something that you absolutely have to know. So a patient with which of the following disorders is at increased risk of malignant hyperthermia susceptibility compared to the general population? A, Guillain-Barré syndrome. B, Duchenne muscular dystrophy. C, hyperkalemic periodic paralysis. D, neuroleptic malignant syndrome.
Yeah, and I think this is a tricky one because, for example, you might see hyperkalemic periodic paralysis and think, oh, that sounds, you know, like a problem, although maybe more with potassium. But I think this is just, like you said, Jillian, one of those things you just have to know, right? There's no way to reason this out. And, you know, what I kind of remember is that there are those, I think there's very few, actually. There used to be this thought that there were a lot. And right now we kind of know that some of those things people thought used to be associated with malignant hyperthermia are not. But Guillain-Barré syndrome is one that is. And so that's the answer here. And the other ones, I think, are those core, like central core disease.
Central core disease and multi-mini core disease. So yeah, those are the three. Yeah, I think they used to lump all of the disorders that could cause profound hyperkalemia into the MH susceptible because it looks very similar, right? You're going to have rhabdomyolysis and hyperkalemia, like it's going to look very similar in the beginning, but what we do realize now is that they are their own things and unique entities. And the hyperkalemia issues is not malignant hyperthermia, but definitely need to know. You have to know this. I really recommend Anki. I don't know if you guys have heard of Anki. It's like a digital flashcards. And so when you have things that you just have to rote memorize that you can't intuit or think through, make an Anki flashcard. And the nice thing about them is they'll repeat the ones you miss more often, right? So it's like spaced repetition, but they also will bring up the ones that you're missing. And I've had residents who've kind of struggled with this type of thing, like just the rote memorization, and the Anki has really helped them. So
yeah, people, I've never used it myself because it didn't exist back when I was studying, but I think our students and residents these days really like it.
Yeah. I mean, I kind of did like the OG style, you know, the stack of note cards. Yeah. Through them. And then once you really felt like you knew something, you got rid of the, you know, the stack got smaller and smaller, but it's like that, but you know, it's digital and more interactive and more fun.
Yeah. That was Anki 1.0.
You weren't exactly. Yeah. I just probably aged myself there, but that's okay. All right. The next question. So an 18-year-old male with Duchenne muscular dystrophy presents for a gastric tube placement. Which of the following is most likely to be found in his preoperative evaluation? A, an FEV1 40% and an FVC 90% of predicted value on PFTs. B, dilated cardiomyopathy with valvular regurgitation. C, elevated creatinine. And D, respiratory alkalosis.
Yeah. So as you said, kind of up top, these patients can have a dilated cardiomyopathy. And therefore, anytime you have a dilated cardiomyopathy, you can end up with valve regurgitation. So B is the right answer here. I think what they're getting at with A is to try to make you think they're giving you numbers that are consistent with a restrictive respiratory pathology, which they can develop. But this is not what you would see. You would see a low FEV1, but you'd also see a low FVC. And so they're giving you a high FVC and therefore, or normal to high. And so that is not consistent with restrictive respiratory defect. So that is why A is wrong. And then C and D are not things that they necessarily see.
And again, this is a really common question. I remember studying this. Like I actually remember this from 15 years ago, longer than that, studying for my exam. They really want you to know about the cardiac muscle because it is muscle. It's also affected. So it's like Dr. Wilpa said, the dilated cardiomyopathy with valve regurgitation, but also conduction defects, arrhythmias, and right ventricular dysfunction. And I also think it's interesting that cardiac dysfunction does not correlate with a degree of muscle weakness. So someone may not have that much skeletal muscle weakness, but may have a really bad cardiac deficit. So that's also important preoperatively to know.
And actually, I'm sorry, I want to go back. I said that wrong. Patients with a restrictive defect would have a high FEV1 and a low FVC. So this is actually, they've reversed it because I think of those patients as having like a they're like a tightly coiled spring, right? They can't get much in, but then they can kind of get it out very quickly, but then that's all they can get out. So they have a low total volume, but they can get that first second out really quickly because they don't have a restriction to flow coming out or an obstruction to flow coming out. They just have a restriction that they can't get much in. So FEV1 would be normal or even high, FVC would be low. So it's the reverse of what they've given there.
And then moving on to the next question, a 5-year-old male with Duchenne muscular dystrophy is most likely to have which of the following complications after exposure to an anesthetic that includes sevoflurane? So A, cardiac failure, B, respiratory insufficiency, C, rhabdomyolysis and hyperkalemia, D, malignant hyperthermia.
Right, so this is that tricky piece where, you know, you might think, oh, all those things are linked to malignant hyperthermia. They're not. But you can see the rhabdomyolysis and the hyperkalemia, which is why they used to be thought to be linked with malignant hyperthermia. But as you said earlier, Jillian, it's not a true malignant hyperthermia. So C is the answer there.
And you can see, and it is very common in Duchenne muscular dystrophy to have cardiac failure and respiratory insufficiency, but that usually comes later in life, usually not at age 5. And then sevoflurane, like we talked about, can cause the rhabdomyolysis, and it's not just succinylcholine. So the question was most likely, and those are really tricky because in way A, B, and C could all be correct in the right patient, but they're asking about like the most likely, and that is the most likely thing in a 5-year-old. Okay, this question is kind of tricky. That's why I liked it. It's a 16-year-old female. So a girl is coming in for an appendectomy. Her younger brother has been diagnosed with Duchenne muscular dystrophy. She has a normal physical exam and denies a history of weakness. She is at risk for which of the following perioperative events? A, abnormal response to non-depolarizing muscle relaxants. B, respiratory insufficiency. C, cardiac arrest. D, aspiration. And I will just say that I did not know this. I got this wrong. The only reason I know it is because I read the answers.
Yeah, I think this is very tricky. It is important that it's a female. And again, she may be a carrier of the muscular dystrophy gene. She isn't manifesting it, obviously, because she is a female. So she's got two X chromosomes. But being a carrier of that may put her at risk for some of the complications of the disease. Now, which ones, again, I would not be sure. I think it's probably cardiac arrest in that she maybe have some amount of susceptibility to the sevoflurane or whatever agents they're using. I don't know if they told us. I don't think they told us specifically what agents, but just perioperatively, she may be susceptible to the agents in a way that he was. But, again, she's probably not weak since she doesn't have the full-blown disease. So I think respiratory insufficiency is probably a little less likely, as it would be aspiration. And then an abnormal response to non-depolarizing muscle relaxants. I think that's tough because that does seem a little tempting too. I'd probably decide between that and the cardiac arrest. And again, I can't tell you I know the answer for sure without
looking it up. I didn't know what they were, and I'll read the explanation, but I thought it was really interesting because it's actually something I have not thought about, but probably should have. Is they're saying that because she has a first degree relative with Duchenne muscular dystrophy, she's possibly a carrier. So probably like 50-50 that she's a carrier. And if she is a carrier, she may have underlying cardiomyopathy. So just like the males whose cardiac deficits can be worse than their weakness, you could see someone who's a carrier not have any weakness, but still have an underlying cardiomyopathy significant enough to cause intraoperative cardiac failure. And then she's also at risk for rhabdo and hyperkalemia, which they didn't give us. That would have been the easy response, right? They gave us the much harder one. But I like this question because I had to think about DMD in like not a boy and like a woman being a carrier. It's not something you think about frequently, at least for me. Okay, the next question, 7. Each of the following conditions causes resistance to non-depolarizing neuromuscular blockade except. So A is chronic severe infections, B is major burns, C is myotonia congenita, D is prolonged immobilization, and E is upper motor neuron injury. So I put this question in here because I don't think that I realize that myotonia congenita is actually not myotonia dystrophy. They're actually two distinct things. And so I wanted to make sure when we're going through this that we made a point of that this is not a dystrophy.
Yeah. So that's tricky. And then the key thing I think to this question is realizing that what makes someone resistant to non-depolarizing neuromuscular blockers is having extra junctional receptors, right? So it's, if you have more acetylcholine receptors, you're going to be resistant to non-depolarizing blockers, just like the reverse. If you have fewer, like in myasthenia gravis, you have fewer receptors, then you are resistant to SUCs. And the opposite is true here. If you have more receptors, you're resistant to non-depolarizers. So we want to look at those same things we talked about that would make you susceptible to hyperkalemia from SUCs. So chronic severe infections, that's actually interesting. Maybe does it, though. I think that's less commonly thought about. Major burns, definitely. Prolonged immobilization, definitely. Upper motor neuron injury, definitely. So we can get rid of B, D, and E, and then we're left with A and C. Chronic severe infections, depending on what it does and if it causes any kind of denervation, puts you in the ICU, immobile for a long time, those kind of things could lead to it. So A, probably we can get rid of, and that leads to myotonia congenita, which, again, I wouldn't know much about that, but you can probably narrow yourself down to that answer. And then, as you said, Jillian, it turns out that that actually is different than the muscular dystrophies.
Yeah. So myotonia congenita is distinguished from myotonia dystrophy in that you get the muscle contractions, but you don't have all the other things. So it's like it's its own unique thing. But I think, like I said, it's important to know the difference because they're not interchangeable.
All right. Stay with us. We'll be right back. All right, and we're back with another question with Jillian Isaac.
Question 8. A 5-year-old boy with myotonic dystrophy type 1 is scheduled for laparoscopic G2 placement. Which of the following medications is most likely to cause myotonic contraction? Lidocaine, desflurane, rocuronium, succinylcholine.
Yeah, so I think this is a little tricky in terms of knowing exactly what they're getting at with myotonic contraction. But I think if you had to think about anything here that's going to cause contraction, it would be succinylcholine, right? That causes contractions. Rocuronium, we know, does not, and des and lidocaine, you know, do not. So I think that probably I'd go with succinylcholine, though I have to admit, when they say myotonic contraction, I don't know if they mean something specific to myotonic dystrophy or if they just mean muscle contraction.
Yeah, I think it's the myotonic dystrophy. That what's unique about myotonic dystrophy versus like a DMD or a BMD is that it's not just, it's the muscle weakness and myotonia. So they have these moments like, so say you go to like turn your doorknob, your hand gets stuck and it can't relax. So that's really the difference. Whereas the myotonia congenita, it's the same thing. You go to like open the door and your hand can't relax, but you don't have all the other things that you see with dystrophy. So that's the difference between the two.
Gotcha. Okay. Okay.
So you're right. The answer was succinylcholine. And then I put this in because I had never heard this before and I just thought it was interesting. So it's a 12-year-old with myotonia congenita, so not the dystrophy, undergoing a reduction and fixation of a fracture, and he develops a sustained muscle contraction intraoperatively. Which of the following interventions will relieve myotonic contractions? So A, neuromuscular blockade with rocuronium, B, peripheral nerve blockade with lidocaine, C, decrease in intracellular calcium with dantrolene, or D, sodium channel blockade with procainamide.
Yeah, I think this is very tricky. You know, I think what is happening here is contraction at the level of the muscle, not the nerve.
Right.
So, you know, blocking with rock or lidocaine,
that's exactly
not going to help because these are affecting the nerve. Decreasing intracellular calcium with dantrolene is interesting, and sodium channel blockade with procainamide. Also, I can imagine a mechanism where that's going to kind of balance out the membrane potential. I'd probably have to decide between those, though. I wouldn't know the answer off the top of my head.
Yeah. And like I said, I did look at that, the myotonic dystrophy website. And one of the things that they talk about are the triggers of the actual myotonia, and a lot of drugs can do it, but also like being cold. So there are things that you can do to just try to prevent it. And that's always what you want to do, is try to prevent the myotonia. But if you did get it, in theory, you could give procainamide. Have I ever seen it? No. Have I ever done this? No. But it was like a very interesting, it's more like a thoughtful question, right?
Yeah,
like just knowing how these drugs work on what level. All right. So this is the last question in the dystrophy category. So it's an 18-year-old with myotonic dystrophy coming in for an elective orthopedic procedure. He has minimal symptoms of his disease, but has family members who have developed severe systemic symptoms related to this diagnosis. Preoperative counseling regarding anesthetic risk for this patient should include which of the following? A, no cardiac evaluation is necessary at this time. B, postoperative ventilation may be required. C, responses to sedative medications will be normal. And D, the risk for malignant hyperthermia is increased.
Yeah. So, you know, this is a patient with some weakness, not a lot, but family members with more severe. So he's definitely got the disease, and maybe some subclinical weakness that's going to be uncovered. So I think certainly post-op ventilation may be required. These patients can be difficult to extubate. I think that's probably the most likely. No cardiac evaluation is necessary. No, I think these patients need a cardiac evaluation.
Everyone with dystrophy does. Yep.
Yep. The risk for malignant hyperthermia is increased. We know that's not true. We already talked about that. Response to sedative medications will be normal. I think they're more sensitive, right?
Yeah.
So that's
they
not
are
right.
more sensitive. Yeah.
Yeah.
So and I will just say, B. Oh, sorry.
No, that leaves B as the correct answer. Yeah.
I will say that these stems are not infrequent in the oral boards also, because there are just so many things you can talk about in terms of drugs, like post-op complications, intraoperative complications, hyperkalemia, cardiac issues, like pre-evaluation. So just keep that in mind. I know this is more for written board review, but these type of stems really common. Am I allowed to say? I don't think I'm allowed to say. I can't, sorry. What was on my oral board? I think, yeah. But I just think there's a lot you can draw from them.
Yeah.
Okay. So moving from dystrophy to trisomy 21, we all know trisomy 21, but the things to really focus on in terms of like anesthesia is, so patients with Down syndrome may have an airway complicated by both macroglossia, tonsillar and adenoidal hypertrophy, micronathia, and a short neck. They may have obstructive sleep apnea and then really lax cervical ligaments, as well as other cervical abnormalities, like it says odontoid, I guess, leading to cervical instability. So they can have atlanto-occipital instability. Children and adults may need smaller size endotracheal tubes because they tend to have smaller tracheas. And about half of these patients have congenital heart disease, half of which are Cushing defects, so AV canal. But you can also see ASD, VSD, tetralogy, PDAs. Those people who do have left to right shunts will develop pulmonary hypertension before patients without Down syndrome. So they're at increased risk for those left to right shunts and pulmonary hypertension. And then it's really common to see developmental delay and hypotonia. So just to go through, like, these are really, really, I even remember studying this for mine, right? Like, these are really common points that they want you to know, especially the airway, the macroglossia, the micronathia, short neck, OSA, cervical instability, cardiac, the congenital heart disease, pulmonary, OSA, and then neuromuscular development delay, hypotonia. So again, there's so many questions that can come from trisomy 21. And I like this first question. It is really hard, but it starts off with a 5-year-old girl with trisomy 21 coming in for an abdominal procedure. So in my head, immediately, I just start thinking of everything trisomy 21, and then it pivots to the patient has narrow angle glaucoma. Which of these medications can be safely used for this patient? So it has nothing to do with like the 5-year-old or the trisomy 21. They really want you to know what drug you should not give in narrow angle glaucoma. So the answer choices are A, glycopyrrolate, B, atropine, C, scopolamine, and D, pilocarpine.
Yeah. And I think a really important test-taking tip here, right, is read the whole question, because what you said, Jillian, if you had read the first sentence and then you take a pause and you spend 5 minutes, going through all this stuff in your head about what could they be asking about,
and
then you realize, actually, you don't even need to, right? So you don't want to waste time without knowing what they're actually asking. And sometimes I find this on my MoCA question. Sometimes they'll give you this whole chart of labs and vitals, and then you don't need any of that to answer the question, right? So you want to be very careful not to waste your time.
I don't know if this is good advice or not, but this is something that I do on standardized tests, is I read the punchline, so to speak, first. So if it's like what medication can be used safely, when I'm reading the stem, I know what to look for. So it just saves me some time.
Right. So what you want to know here, and this, by the way, could apply to any person with glaucoma. It does not have to be a kid or a person with trisomy 21. Right. So what you want to know here is that pilocarpine is actually a treatment for narrow angle glaucoma because it is not an anticholinergic, but a cholinergic. And so that is the answer, because that will actually help. Scopolamine is an anticholinergic. Atropine, obviously, is the prototypical anticholinergic, and glycopyrrolate is an anticholinergic. So all of these will cause it to be worse. Anticholinergics cause glaucoma to be worse. Cholinergics, like pilocarpine, will treat it. So that's the answer here.
So this next question, I will say that I got it from a pediatric anesthesiologist board review. So it is a very tough question. I just think it's more for the thought behind it. And I have seen women coming into L&D who have had Fontan repair. So in that regard, I have seen this before. So this is a 21-year-old woman with a history of trisomy 21 and unbalanced atrioventricular septal defect, status post a non-fenestrated Fontan completion, is undergoing general anesthesia for a cardiac MRI. The patient is having dyspnea on exertion. Labs are within normal limits. Her hematocrit is 35%. Prior to induction of anesthesia using propofol, fentanyl, and rocuronium, what would be the most appropriate action? So A, control potential reflex tachycardia with esmolol. B, start a dopamine infusion. C, reduce FiO2 to prevent pulmonary overcirculation. D, give red blood cells to improve oxygen carrying capacity.
Yeah, so they're telling you the hematocrit is 35. So oxygen, you know, hematocrit is not the problem here. So you can get rid of D, and you certainly aren't looking at a pulmonary overcirculation problem. So, you know, I think you can get rid of C. What you're looking at is a patient who has a Fontan, who has some dyspnea on exertion and may have, and is trisomy 21. So is at risk for, you know, heart failure in general. So I think having an inotrope on board to help move things forward is probably a good idea. I'd probably go with the dopamine infusion.
Right. Yeah. So Fontan patients, they require intravascular volume. It's a passive return of venous systemic flow directly to the pulmonary circulation. So it's more of a thought. You're probably not going to see this on like a advanced. It's a little bit more advanced than that, but I thought it was just interesting way to think through a Fontan repair. So the next one, this is actually a really common question. Down syndrome, not Down syndrome, but it is the stem is a 2-year-old boy with trisomy 21 is undergoing repair of a transitional AV canal defect. Shortly after inhalational induction with sevoflurane, his heart rate falls from 110 to 70 beats per minute. His blood pressure is now 70 over 55 and his O2 sat is 100%. What is the most appropriate management? So A, no treatment indicated. B, phenylephrine, 1 microgram per kilogram IV. C, glycopyrrolate, 10 micrograms per kilogram IV. And D, reduced the inspired oxygen fraction from 100% to 21%.
So I think, you know, again, I don't do kids, but I'm thinking that I remember that kids don't do well with bradycardia, right?
Right.
So probably exactly. The problem.
Right,
here.
Right. Yeah. You could basically strip down this question, like take away the trisomy 21, take away the AV canal defect. This is basically a kid that's brady on induction. What do you do?
Right. So bradycardia, not good in kids, leading to hypotension. So treat the bradycardia with glycopyrrolate. I think that's going to be the answer.
And I like this question because there are a lot of distractors, like there's a lot going on. And if you just doubt yourself, it'd be easy to fudge this one. But, you know, really, I think that's a really common slip up in standardized tests is people get really caught up in what they don't know and they doubt what they do know. And so like the wrong answers really distract them. So again, like strip this down to like its basic question, bradycardia on induction of peds, glyco. Yeah. I'm actually just going to skip the next one because I think it's really complicated and the explanation is really complicated. And I took that one from a pediatric board review and I think it's a little too much for this forum. So moving on to question 5 then. So a 2-year-old male with a history of trisomy 21 is scheduled for an ophthalmic exam under anesthesia. With regard to planning airway management, which of the following statements regarding the airway management is true? And this is such a common advanced test question, like almost guaranteed test question. A, microglossia may make for a challenging direct laryngoscopy. B, hypertonia may be present causing upper airway obstruction. C, macronathia is a common finding. D, airway manipulation may be limited due to potential for cervical spine instability.
Yeah. So what they've given you the opposite in A, B, and C. So it's right. Macroglossia that they have, not microglossia. So the A's out. It's hypotonia, not hypertonia. So B's out. It's micrognathia, not macrognathia. So C's out. So they've just reversed A, B, and C to make those all wrong. And then yes. And I think what you were getting at, Jillian, is that these patients do have a potential for cervical spine instability. And so you want to be careful with manipulating their airway.
So next one, question 6, the incidence of each of the following is increased in patients with Down syndrome, which is trisomy 21, except A, malignant hyperthermia, B, congenital heart disease, C, smaller trachea, D, occipito-atlantoaxial instability.
Yeah. So this is one of the, all of the following except. So right. You probably won't see those anymore, but a lot of older questions do have this. Just be careful if you're practicing with those. The incidence of each of the following is increased in all the following except. So we're looking for one where it's not increased. So congenital heart disease is increased in patients with a trisomy 21. They do have a smaller trachea. They do have occipital atlantoaxial instability. So we're left with A, malignant hyperthermia, which they are not more susceptible than the general population.
which we talked about in the dystrophy section. Yeah. All right, last question. And again, the questions 5, 6, and 7, in my opinion, if you're going to get a question about a trisomy 21 kid, these are like the money questions. So the last one is anomalies and features associated with Down syndrome include A, smaller tracheas, B, elanto-occipital instability, C, the thyroid hypofunction, D, all of the above.
Yeah, and so the answer here is all of the above, as we've discussed.
Yeah, and then again, for oral boards, there's just a lot that they can use from a stem with someone who's got like trisomy 21. You know, you could walk down a difficult airway. You could do a tonsillectomy and then a bleeding tonsil. Like there's a lot here with these keywords. So hopefully this was helpful.
Absolutely.
The trip down memory lane.
Yes. Yeah. Definitely reaching back in the armamentarium of residency for me. And med school. All right, Jillian, do you have a random recommendation for us?
I knew you were going to ask it, and I'm chuckling because it is really random, but something that I thought a lot about, and this is an unpopular opinion, but my son had a soccer tournament in Orlando. It was an international invitational. It was the first time we've actually played like on an international level. We played some teams from like Mexico and South America. It was really fun, but I've never taken my kids to Disney World. So we decided we're going to Orlando. We've already paid for like the hotel. We're going to be there. We might as well extend the trip by a few days and like go to the parks. I really don't like Disney World, but I love the Universal Studios, especially the Harry Potter parts of them. Oh my gosh, it's so well done. And I mean, it's really worth the money. But in my opinion, skip Disney, go to Orlando, go hang out in Hogsmeade and in Diagon Alley.
Nice. That sounds awesome. We were supposed to go in March of 2020. Mm-hmm. So we did not.
I'm kind of relieved. My kids didn't love Disney World either. I think it was like around spring break time and the parks, they were just uncomfortably crowded. It just wasn't even fun. I mean, everywhere you turned and looked, it was a person.
Yeah. I think it's supposed to be great. And my kids did like Harry Potter. So one of these days we'll get there. All right. I'm going to recommend a book that I just read. It's called Demon Copperhead by Barbara Kingsolver.
She's one of my favorite authors. I just reread The Poison War Bible. It's one of my favorite books of all times.
I actually have never read anything by her before this. And I really liked it. It was really interestingly written and powerful. I mean, it's really a commentary on, poverty in rural America and the opioid epidemic, and really interesting. But it's made me want to read more by her. So you would recommend another one, Jillian?
It's called The Poisonwood Bible. I have a hard copy. I'll bring it in for you to borrow. It, for me, I've read all of her books. I think she's a wonderful writer, but it is, to me, her best work. It's the story. It's set in the 60s. It's a white family whose dad is a minister. There's four daughters. They decide to go be missionaries in the Congo. And so he takes his family to this like small village in the Congo to try to convert them to Christianity. And I think it really deals with colonialism and ministries and Christianity. It's so well done. It's so fascinating. And every chapter is told by like a different person and it keeps like circling around. There's just so many layers to the story. It's beautiful. Just really good writing.
Very cool. I'll definitely check it out. Well, Jillian, thanks so much for coming back on the show. All right. Hopefully you got as much out of that as I did. That was really fantastic. Let us know what you thought. Go to the website, acrac.com, where you can leave a comment. Others can learn from what you have to say. If you are a fan of the show, you can follow us. We're on Twitter. We are on Facebook. We are on Reddit. And we are on Instagram. I'm at Jay Wolpaw on Twitter, and we're at Acrac Podcast. And you can find us on all those other platforms as well. If you are a fan of the show, please consider going to Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts and leaving a comment and a rating. It really helps others find the show. If you'd like to support the making of the show, please consider going to patreon.com/acrac. That's patreon.com/accrac, where you can become a patron of the show. Even if it's just a dollar or two that you pledge, it makes a big difference and we really appreciate it. You can also make donations anytime by going to paypal.me/acrac. Or looking up Jay Wolpaw on Venmo. Thank you so much to those who have already made donations and become patrons. We really appreciate it. Thanks, as always, to our fantastic ACRAC crew. Dr. Brian Park is our tech lead. Sonia Amanat and Chris Reese are our social media managers. Dr. April Liu and Edison Jang are our production assistants. Thank you so much for all that you do. Our original ACRAG music is by Dr. Dennis Kuo. You can check out his website at studymusicproject.com. All right, that is it for today. For the ACRAG podcast, I'm Jed Wolpaw. Thanks for listening. Remember, what you're doing out there every day is really important and valued.
Are you looking for legit ways to make extra money? Our friends at The Side Hustle Show have put together this cool free 60-second quiz to help you do just that. All you got to do is go to hustle.show. You can do it right from your phone. Answer a few short multiple choice questions, and it'll recommend a few episodes of the hit Side Hustle Show podcast to start with. You can add your personalized Side Hustle Show playlist to your device, learn what works, and start making more money today. Again, that's at hustle.show, or follow the award-winning Side Hustle Show in your favorite podcast app.